Nassim Harriman's earth-shattering equations on the unification of all things. First of all, I can listen to a great track from my husband, Modine Montross, Stop the Reptilians. It's a great song. Website is www.illuminashow.com. Enjoy the rest of this presentation by Nassim Harriman.
And you're listening to Sailing Beyond Knowledge.
Isn't that sweet? I thought so. In my paper, this word child proton, I actually put a line in there. I didn't, you know, you have to like sneak in, you know, in the physics community. So I didn't say, this is a mathematical proof that everything is one. That would have been a little bit over the top. Bad enough, I was telling them that atoms are black holes and they're classical, they're not quantum objects. So, I said, this is evidence that the universe may be entangled through all atoms or all protons using or through the structure of the vacuum. And, you know, I thought my paper might be refused when I submit it, you know, at the physics conference, you know. Wouldn't have been the first time. So I was pleasantly surprised when the director of the conference in the middle of the week, this is 2 years ago, pulled me aside and said, I'd like to talk to you. And I thought, there it comes. Here we go. Why is it that I feel like a teenager again? And he said, well, you know, we noticed on your schedule that you're leaving before the awards ceremony. I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, kind of busy, got things to do, you know, I typically don't win awards in physics conference. And he's like, well, we'd like you to stay. I'm like, can't really do that. He's like, well, you won the first paper award for physics in our conference. And I thought, I had changed dimensions. I almost fainted. I'm like, can I take a chair? Like, you gotta be kidding. He's like, no, I'm not kidding. I've got papers in the contest myself, and you won. And this paper then went on to be published at the American Institute of Physics and is available on the internet. It received serious amount of tomatoes afterwards. Plenty of tomatoes going. Upset a lot of people that paper won an award since, you know, it gets rid of most of quantum theory. And the need for a $13 billion experiment that keeps going on. You know, lately it blew up because a bird put a little crumb in the wrong place. So, this was sweet, but I was in the end of the calculation. 10 to the 55th is too much energy to make the proton and black hole. It's plenty. 10 to the 55th is the mass of the universe, and inside the bubble of our universe, it's massive enough to make the whole universe a black hole. So, you know, you don't need all that for the proton to be a black hole. So how do you figure out what is the mass of the black hole proton? Well, you run the Schwarzschild equation. The Schwarzschild equation, which is just on the verge of being made irrelevant by my new paper, is the solution to Einstein's field equation that tells you the radius of the black hole. So R sub s is the radius Schwarzschild is equal to 2 multiplied by the gravitational constant multiplied by the mass over the speed of light squared. If you run this, right, you will know what the radius of the black hole would be for such a mass. But I know what the radius of the proton is. What I need to know is what's the mass. So this is the equation the way it is up here. That's the radius, that's the gravitational constant, that's the mass, which is unknown, and that is the speed of light squared. In order to get the mass from the equation, I need to reverse that so that the mass equals the speed of light multiplied by the radius over the gravitational constant. Right? You all follow this? Alright. We'll make like you did. And the result is 10 to the 14 grams. 10 to the 14 grams, which happens to be approximately what you've used, is 10 to the minus 39% of the energy available in the vacuum, right? The 10 to the 55th. You've used a teeny, weeny, beady little portion, very teeny portion, of the energy available in the structure of space to produce the proton. That is, all the atoms in the universe are using a teeny, weeny, little bit of what the energy available is. So imagine if we figure out all these vacuum functions and we tap a teeny, weeny, beady, little teeny, beady tenth of a millionth of a percent of a billionth of a percent, we'd have enough energy in one device to run the whole planet. Okay? Forever. Nice. Anywhere in the universe, because there's vacuum everywhere. So, you're not limited. And the day is coming when you will see technology that does that, extract energy from the vacuum continuously, you know, so you're not tied to a grid anymore or anything like that. That's coming very, very quickly. And the thing is, the hit is that if you say that to a physicist, he'll say, hey, slow down, buddy. The standard mass of proton is 10 to the minus 24. You came up with 10 to the 14 grams. You're 38 orders of magnitude off. Okay? Not trivial. And this is when that Tim has one of those days. I'm off by 38 orders of magnitude. Oh my God! I know what happened. But luckily, the Buddha is around, as you can tell. And it comes to me and says, hey, stay calm. The key is the strong force, dear one. And what is the strong force? The strong force is what I call physics as you go. We have a way of doing physics on this planet that, you know, I call physics as you go. That is, you find something that really doesn't work in your stuff. And instead of re-examining your stuff, you start inventing shit. We did that recently when we discovered that we were missing 96% of the mass of the universe. In order for it to behave the way it does, as we observe it, it needed to have 96% more mass. So what did we do? Instead of revising the equation, we said, huh, we're going to invent dark matter. We're going to make it matter that does not radiate, that doesn't interact with real matter, and that's exactly in the right proportion, in exactly the right place, so that it does exactly the right thing. And look, now our equation works. Dark matter must exist. Let's go to Congress. We should get billions of dollars for experiments trying to find dark matter. 20 years later, billions and billions and billions of dollars later, it's like, that doesn't work. Well, that's physics as you go. 100 years ago, we discovered that the protons in the atom are charged. They have a positive static charge. That's what they call protons. And just like two magnets that push against each other, they should repel. But that repulsion should blow all the nuclei of all the atoms apart. Atoms should not exist. When they discovered this, they didn't have black holes. In fact, Einstein had written his equations which predict black holes, but they thought that part of the equation was irrelevant. They said, oh, that goes to singularity, you know, we're never going to find anything like that, it doesn't exist. We can't ignore that part. And so they said, well, you know, these protons, if they're repelling with that strength, gravity cannot do the job. It's too weak. There must be a force that we don't know about. We'll call it the strong force. And we'll make it exactly what it needs to be to squish the two together. Physics as you go. When they did that, they omitted to write any physics that explained where that force came from, how much energy it takes to produce it, how it got there. They just put it in. Imagine doing physics in such a way that you're putting in the strongest force in the universe and it's just not going to say where it came from. You're not going to account for it. And you get away with it for 100 years plus. Later they realize, oh my God, there's little bitty things inside the proton called quarks. And they're compressed into an even smaller radius. And they have a charge. So now we need a stronger force. You can't just go back out and say, well, we just discovered a new force. Bleep, bleep, bleep. New force discovered. The strong, strong force. Stronger than the stronger force. That just wouldn't look good, right? So they got artistic. They called it the color force. And they said, well, you know, the color force is infinitely strong. They figure like that, find anything smaller, we're good, man. We got infinitely strong force going on here. It's infinitely strong. So it's impossible to split the quarks apart. But if you were thinking of an object with infinitely strong compressive force in the middle of it, what would you think that is? A black hole. Instead, we've got gluons. Which is the particles that mediate the color force. So then I start asking, who made the blue? Yeah. So since LQCD, that's XQCD, has no analytical solution for the power force or the strong force, there's actually no physics. And I assure you, they try. They spent billions and billions and billions of dollars on supercomputers to try to render an equation for the power force. No analytical solution has been found. So, since that problem occurred, if you ask a physicist, well, how strong is the strong force? It can't just give you a nice little equation, oh, you solve that, and da-da-da-da-da. They'll tell you, well, if it was a ratio, if gravity is 1, guess what? The strong force is 10 to the 38 times stronger. That is supposedly what I'm off by. 10 to the 38 times the standard mass. In my case, however, I have accounted for the force necessary to confine the proton in the nucleus of an atom. They did it. So if you're going to throw shit in, you probably are going to come off short. And that was my argument in the Schwarzschild proton paper. It received serious amount of tomatoes, especially after I announced that I had won an award. And, you know, there started almost a year and a half of, you know, internet insanity. Now, I knew this was not going to convince the average physicist. Because in fact, you know, it's only the very, very, very skilled physicist, which you will not see on the internet throwing tomatoes at this, that understands the complexities involved enough to know, yes, the strong force and the color force is a problem, and this may be a way to resolve it. Now, I knew it was going to take more than the equation, so I wrote a scaling law. Because that's based on data. The radius of an object... if I put my nose in there, I cover most of this. the radius of the object to this mass. And I plotted the objects in the universe, starting with the universe and the Planck's distance, and then stuff in between. And if you download the paper from the net, you'll see I put much more stuff in there, but I don't have time to do that in my presentation. In any case, all this stuff. And I, so that you get a good sense of the average of that line, and then I plotted the Schwarzschild proton, the black hole proton, and guess what? Ba-boom! Right on the line. And I plotted the standard proton, and guess what? Ba-boom! Right off the line. In fact, in left field. So, this is straight data, kind of embarrassing. But you know what? There's comments that were made on this, which I was aware of, but I hadn't chosen to address that in that paper, which said, well, you know, this is interesting. However, the mass of the universe is calculated using the standard mass of the proton, not the black hole mass of the proton. So if we use your mass, the mass of the universe would go up there and then you would be off too. So, good point. And at the same time, this shows very clearly that objects tend to the black hole condition. So, how is this working? And how is it that we only observe that, but it has a mass of that? Right? This was a great question that was asked by most of the physicists. And this is where I cut in. You understand, you know, a few weeks ago, actually a few months ago then, the conference, the physics conference, the CASTI conference, asked me, you know, after the four child proton, they received a lot of hate mail as well, but how could you have given an award to the space provider? You know? And so I was surprised when I received an email from the director saying, we'd like you to submit an invited paper for the CASTI 2011 conference. Because I thought, oh my God, these guys are never going to want to see me again. And, you know, I had a tour scheduled, so I had to write and solve these equations while touring. Which is a tour de force. I tell you, it's hard to render physics and give talks at the same time. This can be done, however, it takes some serious concentration. Never mind that the tour at that point was mostly in Europe, and I had a 12-hour, you know, time change with Hawaii, where my assistant, physics assistant, Dr. Heisen is, and so I had to work all night, and then meetings and talks all day, and so, you know, it was a little bit epic. Well, I solved it. Because it had to be done. And so here I'm going to jump to that part, which is my new paper. This is, you're going to be some of the first people to see this. So there is this great problem, and let me open the paper so we have both. There is this great problem in physics. And this great problem is called the vacuum catastrophe. Oh my God. So, let's take a look at the paper. So here, we address the 120 orders of magnitude discrepancy between the cosmological constant dark energy and the vacuum fluctuation density predicted by quantum field theory and deemed the so-called vacuum catastrophe. This is the largest discrepancy in all of physics. In general, it's not discussed so much. 120 orders of magnitude discrepancy is not trivial. And that's 120 zeros on a number, you know. So, this problem occurs when they realize that the universe is not only expanding, but it's accelerating. So let me give you a little history. When Einstein wrote his equation said that the universe was expanding. And he didn't like that, because at the time, the prevalent thought was that the universe is static, not expanding. So to make sure that he wouldn't get too many tomatoes thrown at him, he put a fudge factor in. He had a weakness moment. He did physics as you go for an instant. And it bit it. Because, sure enough, a few years later, Hubble realized that the universe must be expanding. And when they removed the fudge factor, which was called the cosmological constant, in his equation, the equation predicted what Hubble saw, which is the universe expanding. And Einstein called the cosmological constant then the largest error he's ever done. Later on, we realize that the universe is not only expanding, but it's accelerating as it expands. So physicists went, oh my God, what do we do with that? We have to put energy in the vacuum to make it do that. We have to put the cosmological constant back in to Einstein's equation, but this time make it strong enough so that it won't make the universe static, but it'll make it accelerate as it expands. When they did that, this is where I'm going to start needing this thing. There goes the universe. You guys are going to love this. Check this out. When they did that, the amount of fluctuations in the vacuum at the universal level was 10 to the minus 29 grams per centimeter cubed. Alright? A very, very slight amount of energy in the vacuum was necessary to make it accelerate the way we observe it to do. Okay, you all following this? Mm-hmm. However, remember, at the quantum level, it's 10 to the 93 grams per centimeter cubed. 122 orders of magnitude, right, larger than the cosmological constant. So, how is it that the quantum level is so intensely dense, and at the cosmological level, it's so weak? Right? There came the catastrophe of 120 orders of magnitude. So what I did is I did this in my equations. I've got slides for that first part, but I don't have slides for the rest, and you know, this is so fresh. It was done only a few weeks ago. Actually, a few days ago. Yeah, I mean, like 2 weeks ago. I said, okay, we calculated that all of the vibrations inside the little proton, right, are in the amount of 10 to the 55th grams per centimeter cubed. Right? That's the amount that's present in there. Let's grow that to the size of the universe. And what did I get? 10 to the minus 30 grams per centimeter cubed. Right? If I grow the little proton so that it inflates to the size of the universe, this density of fluctuation of the vacuum in there drops to 10 to the minus 30 grams per centimeter cubed, which is really close to 10 to the minus 29, right? Really, really close. And I'm like, oh, it was nice. And it's simple. Alright? Super easy. And so I'm like, okay, wait. Right? The size of the universe is not anything we have precisely. I'm making a precision calculation on a small number. I need something precise for the size of the universe. When I did this first calculation, all I have is 10 to the 28 centimeters, and in cosmology, they'll tell you it could be as small as 10 to the 27, minus 27, and as, or as, 10 to the 27th or as large as 10 to the 30th. I mean, those are huge differences. I'm trying to make a precise calculation. So I thought, hey, wait a minute. If the energy in the vacuum is true holographic, and holographic theory is in black hole physics. I just want to let you know this is not like some hallucination. We use holographic theory to map the entropy of black holes. But if the vacuum fluctuations are actually a true holographic representation of the mass of the universe, of all the information in the universe, then I know the mass exactly of the universe. And if I do the mass, if I do the Schwarzschild radius for the universe, it will, if I do the black hole radius equation, it will give me a radius for a mass, an exact radius. So I did that. I did the same, and I did the Schwarzschild radius for that mass, and it gave me a radius of 10 to the 27 centimeters, 4.14 10 to the 27 centimeters, and I can get as much accuracy as I need. And then I inflated my universe to that size, and guess what? The density was 10 to the minus 29 grams per centimeter cubed. Boom. Right on the cosmological gospel. That was my first. That was my first seven equations, you know. I just solved 120 orders of magnitude problem in physics. And then I continued with the paper. That was just a warm up. So here I'm going to have to follow with the paper, so you're going to have to bear with me a little bit. Is this blocking the view for people?
Yeah.
It is? It is? Like this? Is that good? Can you see? Okay. Okay, so this was, so here's the equation. Here I calculate how many little plunks vibrations there is in the volume of the proton that gives me the density, or in the centimeter cube of space that gives me the density of the vacuum. And here I calculate how many of these little plunks volume there is inside the proton, and that gives me the 10 to the 55. Which is the amount of vacuum fluctuation. You all following this, right? And, no? Okay, so the little vacuum fluctuations are Planck size, right? I just calculated how many of the little Planck size vibrations there is inside the volume of a proton, right? And that's the 10 to the 55, which is the mass of the universe, right? Everybody's following this?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's R sub rho. Okay, so everybody remember R sub rho is the mass of the universe extrapolated from the vacuum inside a proton, right? Okay, cool. So we go from there, and here you can see I get 10 to the minus 30 for the first estimate, which is 10 to the 28 centimeters for the universe. And then when I do it with the correct value, extrapolated from the Schwarzschild proton for the size of the universe, I get the right answer. That means, by the way, that for the first time in the history of physics, we have an accurate size for the universe, like on the nose. That is, we don't have this wobble between like two or three orders of magnitude. Right? This is the size of the universe. And it comes out right because the vacuum density we observe is the right answer. Okay? Assuming that that's correct, you can continue along that line. This is called the holographic principle. In physics, in black hole physics, it's the number of Planck's oscillation on the surface of the black hole represents its entropy. And I'm not going to bore you with the details, but it's already used a little bit like that, okay, and accepted. So I said, okay, now, guess what? From a little beady atom that I'm able to measure in laboratory, I can get information about the whole universe. This is a little bit like Copernicus, like in his lab, putting geometries together and getting, you know, 98% accuracy on the orbits of the planets without even having to look up. You see what I'm saying? So I'm like, wait, what else can we learn about the universe from looking at this little beady proton in the laboratory, if it's holographic? So I had to calculate the surface area of a little proton. I'm sorry, this is jumping too far, so I'm going to have to use this here. It's getting cramped in here. Okay, I'm going to do this. Okay. Thank you. So, what I first did is I calculated the surface area of a little Planck oscillation. What would be the surface area? A little circle. Man, this is hard. How am I going to do this? Okay, can we move this guy? Let me rearrange things a little bit. Okay. Alright, I'm trying not to block anything on this side here. So, how many of these little black holes, how many of these little Planck oscillations are on the surface of my little proton? On the surface event horizon of the black hole proton. And I had to calculate their area, right? The little circle's area. And then I calculated how big is the surface, right? So that I could figure out how many of them fit on that surface. Man. Okay, so how many of them fit on that surface? So what I divided one by the other, that's equation 9, this is 10. So ANA LAP, sub LAP, is the amount of little Planck structures on the surface of the proton. Right? And there's 10 to the 40th of those guys. And then I said, okay, let's divide the amount of little Planck's oscillation on the surface by R sub rho, the amount, the mass of the universe. Okay? The amount of little Planck's oscillation by the amount of little Planck spheres inside the volume, right? The surface divided by the volume, right? And the result is the exact Schwarzschild solution. The exact Schwarzschild solution with no tensors, no relativistic equations, nothing. It gives the mass of the black hole, right? Without Einstein. Just by simple geometric relationship of Planck's distances to Planck's volume. When that came out, I was like, oh my God. I had to do it over and over again. There must be an error. I looked in the program everywhere. I'm like, no, it's the program. What? So I had to add this right below there. I put, as an aside, we point out this, the beautiful simplicity of this derivation of the Schwarzschild condition, as it is now possible for any high school student equipped with the Planck name to extrapolate the Schwarzschild condition of any object, that is, anything in the universe. I was going to put in the paper a table. I was going to do that for a table, just to like kind of drill it in, but then they told me it's not good. But for any object without the use of the Schwarzschild equation and the conceptual difficulties that can arise from its use, no Einstein field equations. And simple, right? So that means at this point, from this, I can take any sphere, any black hole, anything. Just calculate the surface, divide it by the Planck's area, calculate the volume, divide it by the Planck volume, and boom, divide the two together, Schwarzschild solution. Gravity. This is the solution to gravity. Without complexity. Just simple geometry. You know. Einstein said, when you find a unified field theory, it will be a geometric solution. So, very nice. I'm thinking, wow, this holographic stuff works. So, and by the way, that supports the fact as well that the mass that we're getting inside the proton is the correct mass for the universe. So then, I babble for a while, and I say, well, what else can we learn about our universe from these relationships? And I divide the number of Planck's area on the surface of the proton by the literal volume of the proton, which is 10 minus 39. Remember that? And when I do that division, I get 10 to the 79, which is in the range of what they tell us is the amount of particles in the universe, the amount of protons in the universe. Currently, they think there's about 10 to the 80th protons in the universe. But here, I got an exact number. Exact number. If this number is correct, then I should get exact results from it. Right? So, I said, okay, since I get the Schwarzschild condition geometrically and the number of particles, let's say that I divide the Schwarzschild mass of the proton, you know, it's the Schwarz, well, in this case, it's no longer the Schwarzschild mass, I'm sorry, it's M sub H, which stands for the Hermite mass. Because it's extrapolated geometrically without Einstein, so it's, you know. And I divided that by the number of particles in the universe. So basically, I smeared the mass, I said, okay, the proton is not isolated, it's wormholed to all the other protons in the universe. So the internal mass, the internal vibration in there is split across all these other particles. And so I smeared them over all the other protons in the universe. And so I'm dividing by 10 to the 79. It's a very large number. Right? And so I get 10 to the minus 65, right, with numbers in front of it. And then I said, okay, so now I can calculate the influence of all these other particles holographically reproduced on the surface of the little proton. So this represents one termination of one wormhole, right? Actually be exact, right? The number meant in laboratory is 6726, and I got 6722. This is the standard mass of the proton. This is like, oh my god, I've divided by all the other protons in the universe. Mapped it back to the little teeny surface and I nailed it. Okay? Not a coincidence. Alright? And then I realized, well, this is true, then I should be able to eliminate two of these steps. Just take the amount. If this is truly telling me how many protons there's in the universe, like to the proton, I'm talking like to the proton, right? And you know, and that the internal fluctuation is the true mass of the universe to the gram, right? When I divide the amount of protons by the mass of the universe that is given by the proton, I should get the same result. And that's exactly what I did. I divided r sub rho, which is the mass of the universe, the fluctuation inside it, by the number of protons, and boom, it output the same number. That, you know, that was fun. Between like two buses and a train and like, you know, a talk and 10 meetings and, you know, everything else, it was really sweet. And you have to realize that all of a sudden we have the fundamental yardstick for creation. The fundamental holographic principle at the base of creation, and any high school student can calculate anything he wants or she wants from how many of our universes they would be in a larger one, how many of those universes they would be in a larger one, and so on, and so on, and so on, or how many particles there is below the proton, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on, path of long distance, the wavelet size, not only the amount of these things, their mass, their relationship to each other. Basically, we have the map of the holographic network of creation, so we can navigate the whole thing.
Yeah.
Really important to have. And I personally have been working on this for, you know, since I was born. And I have spent some 30 years meditating on the unification of all things. I've had many deep experience of unification. There is none of them that parallel the experience I had when I solved this equation and felt all of my protons wormhole to all other protons in the universe. And it really gives me a sense of the unification and that of the dance that is occurring in our universe right now. The dance of what is going on internally in the network to what's going on externally in the network. Because remember, I got the external solution here, that is the mass of the universe divided by all the photons in the universe. And I got the internal solution, which gave me the Schwarzschild mass of the protons. The internal solution is the black hole mass. The external solution is the standard mass, which we measure, A, obviously, external to the proton. Right? So what I started to realize is that this thing is entangled with the universe everywhere. These entanglements are like vortices, right? And they connect all points. And these vortices connect the internal fluctuations, right? Of this proton with the internal fluctuation of this one, and of this one, and of this one, and of this one. So they see each other internally. They're communicating. They're talking. And there's no baud rate because this is wormhole structures. It's curved to infinity. There's infinite mass in there. So any vibration in here is replicated in here holographically. And any vibration in there is replicated in there. But, and so when they approach each other, they attract each other with the Schwarzschild mass. They attract each other with the black hole mass, which is what we call the strong force, which is just gravity. But on the outside, we measure the standard mass, because it's the mass of the universe holographically mapped to the surface. And since we just see the surface, that's what we measure. You guys see that? And so this all came together very nicely. Man, I'm going to have fun when I publish this one. We'll try to avoid the tomatoes. I'm sure they're going to fly anyway. And knowing that tomatoes are going to fly, I wrote this section. This next section is this argument circular. Because I know the first thing they're going to say, wait, this is way too close. Right? It must be circular. Right? He must have put the standard mass of the proton in there somewhere unknowingly, and because he's a bad physicist, he didn't realize, because he really doesn't know what he's doing, right? So I definitely went through all the arguments with all the numbers, with all their extension, to make it very clear that in no way the standard mass of the proton was incorporated in the equation, and that in no way was any quantity cherry-picked. That is, nowhere do I say, well, I'll take this number of particles so it comes out clean, or, you know, I'll take this mass of the universe so it comes out nice, or this radius of the universe so it works out, or anything like that. It all is consistent. Right? And then I show that nowhere in the standard derivation of the Planck length, or the Planck energy, or the Planck's mass, is there any standard mass of the proton involved in there anywhere, to make sure, you know, it's clear that it didn't just sneak in somewhere. And so Then, in this section, yeah, you like it? Holography, fractals, wormholes, and black holes. I thought it was pretty cool. The whole fractal graphic universe is the name of the theory, right? And so I'm finally there. And I show the first argument. I start talking about the hairs. That so the black hole, this is a concept in physics currently, is that the black hole has no hair. And that what I'm showing is that no, the black hole is a hippie. And it probably hangs out at Burning Man. See you at Burning Man, guys. And you know this, and so, but the hairs is fractalized. That is, the mathematics themselves shows you that there is a network structure. Why? Because remember, the surface of the little proton has only 10 to the 40th little Planck area. That means there's only 10 to the 40th little wormholes that can terminate there. Right? But there's 10 to the 80th particles, or 79. Right? So, how is it that they're all connected? And I give the argument. Well, that it must be a geometry solution in which, and it involves tetrahedrons and all this, and we don't have to get into that, but secret symbols come into life. Because these little Planck distances are space filling, so they're like flower of life. You all know what flower is. That is the tiling that gives you these solutions. Holy shit! Is what I thought, right? These guys had it right. And but they send to the 40th on the surface, but they send to the 80th proton. So 10 to the 40th are connected, wormholes are connected to 10 to the 40th proton. And then these 10 to the 40th are connected to 10 to the 40th again.
Wow.
And that now you get a sense of the structure. Not only is it holographic, but it's fractal in its growth. And now you get like overtones, you start to get like the whole, you know, yardstick thing. That you can actually extrapolate the whole network geometry of the field and navigate the universe. And so, in that section, I'm not used to having, entanglements on my mind. Okay, where is my mouse? And so then in this section, I show other researchers that have come to similar conclusions that support the Schwarzschild proton model. One of them is Dr. Berinsky. Am I at the end of the paper? I must have. Yes, I must have quantumly. Actually, wormholely. So, here I show that Dr. Berinsky won an award for a paper. And that paper won an award like 2 weeks after mine, after the Sword Child Proton. I was unaware of it, and it was for showing that the electron can be considered a black hole. And that it can be like a little naked singularity black hole. And that it can orbit a proton. And Berensky, which is a scientist at the Academy of Science in Russia, showed as well that the surface event horizon of a black hole has vortices at its poles, and that they're wormholes to the rest of the universe through these vortices. How convenient. Thank you, Mr. Berensky. And in these calculations, he showed then that the event horizon is perforated with wormholes. So nice when people help like that. And then I give another reference to another doctor, this one in astrophysics, that has noticed that when she looks at supermassive black holes or large black holes in the universe, and she calculates the orbits of a smaller black hole orbiting that larger black hole, she gets typical proton-electron orbital relationships. And she gets all of the table of elements with black holes orbiting each other. All the orbitals. Cosmologically. And so, you know, from the infinity big to the infinity small, we have orbiting black holes. And then I give references to the article I just showed you about in Indiana University about the universe may be a black hole, and another reference to another researcher that shows that there is stable orbit inside black holes. The nice paper I actually made the news. It was pretty, you know, outrageous because it shows in his math that there is stable orbit inside black hole, and he made this hypothesis in his paper that, you know, there might be civilization that lives inside supermassive black hole. And when I read the paper, I'm like, dude, you know, check it out. We're one of those. I put that in there. And you know, here is the conclusion of the paper. Here we have demonstrated a clear geometric and holographic relationship between the micro world, the microstructure of the proton, and the macrostructure of the universe.
Ooh.
Right? This relationship cannot be deemed coincidental. So, considering the accuracy of the prediction of both the Schwarzschild condition and the measured mass of the proton. Furthermore, the values extrapolated for the cosmological constant, the size of the universe, and the number of particles in it all fall within widely accepted standard value. That is, it's not all over the place. In fact, my values are the dot correct, since they output the mass of the proton exactly, and the Schwarzschild proton, and the Schwarzschild condition. Therefore, the result stands firmly between relativistic physics and quantum theory as they generate the Schwarzschild condition and the standard mass of the proton from geometric consideration that relates the Planck's unit and the Planck density to cosmological structures, hence generating a framework for scale unification. Yeah. And how are we doing on time? 10:30. We started at 7. Sexy, I thought so. Juicy. And so I wanted to tell you there is a solution as well on this that you might say, well, if the black hole is the little black hole from the people that know the Schwarzschild proton paper, the calculation gives that the proton not only is black hole, but that it's spinning at the speed of light. So they're orbiting each other at the speed of light. So like, you are not only made of these little black holes that are connected to everything in the universe, and you have access because it's internal to you, but on top of it, these little black holes are spinning at the speed of light. And you might say, well, how can they spin if they're all stuck together when they get like really tangled? There's the Dirac solution shows that the electron spin, maybe I should show you the animation.
Yeah.
You guys want to see the animation?
Yeah.
It's old, I gotta pull it out of my butt. It's old, but it's like, it's kind of hard to describe, but it's really sweet because it shows you how an infinite amount of strings can be attached to a point, which is the only solution we have for the electron cloud today. Okay? And spin around a system and never get entangled, so that the strings never get entangled. It's called the Dirac string. And it's a solution, is the only current mathematical solution for the electron spin. I wonder if I could have sound on my laptop here. Probably not, right? Yes? Do you have a cord out here? I can just show the visuals otherwise.
Put the mic near the speaker.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I'll put the mic near the speaker. Very good. Lucky they're geniuses.
Physics at work.
I tell you, all I do is divisions, and people say, "You're a genius." No, man, I just divided shit. Oh man, I'm having fun when it's not filmed. I can swear. Sorry, I just kind of rambled in that. I'm trying to pull this off. Okay, here it is. I'm going to move it over and start it over again. All the things in the universe connected to each other. Paul derived from it.
This is busy.
And so, this amazing. Yeah, I'm understanding. I didn't mean it. That's my little one. I got a new little one. My little electron. He's got lots of energy. And this really kind of brings us to complete understanding of the unification and the deeper structure of unification, the importance of the structure of space, right? The structure of space and the geometry of that structure on all other space, on all other information. People ask me all the time about time. How does time fit in this thing? And I tell them, time does not exist without memory. Alright? No memory, no time. No memory, no evolution. And I'm not talking about little memory in your brain. I'm talking about universal memory. The universe must be able to remember all actions, all points of information at all times in order to have an evolution. So as the information of all your atoms and all your protons in your whole universe is moving through the structure of space, you're mapping information over it. You are imprinting the structure of space. This is why you can get the DNA teleportation thing to happen. This is why there's such a thing as phantom DNA. That is, you can put a DNA in a device that's called a spectrum analyzer, and you can take a measurement, remove the strands of DNA, take another measurement, and it's like it's still in there. It's called phantom DNA. It was discovered by accident. Because somebody went to lunch, had removed the strand of DNA, and somebody started taking measurements, thinking it was in there, and it came out like it was in there, and then when they went to remove it, it was not in there. And so, but then if you say that to a physicist, they'll say, well, that after a while, the effect fades away. The effect didn't fade away. The information didn't go anywhere. The device is moving away from where the information was encoded on the structure of space. That's why you're not reading it anymore, dude. And why is that? Because our sun and our planet don't do things like that. This is wrong. Wrong. Wrong model. Bad. Not good. This is what stops everybody. It's equivalent to telling people the earth is flat. Incorrect. We live in a universe, in a solar system in which the sun is moving at 300 miles per second and at 300 kilometers per second, and as we follow the sun through space, we create large vorticular rotations. And every single moment is different from every other single moment because we're not in the same spot. And every one of these little moments are information of all things in the universe is embedded, recorded by the structure of space-time in that place. This is why you actually remember. And all of the genealogy of all of the beings that came before you is present in your genes because of that spiral structure of information that connects you back to all of your ancestry. Which is something in you know, biology that has not been solved. How does the gene map all the information of thousands of ancestors, right? Which you're the product of. I can take your spiral, just think from the back of your heart chakra, back through space, and map all the information that you've imprinted on the structure of space all the way back to your mother. And because you were inside the event horizon of your mother, and your father was there too for a little while. I can follow their spiral all the way back to their mother, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on, to the infinite universe. This is how information is embedded. And this information is present in that point, having all the other points following that strand leading to your presence. Making your presence exactly what your presence is. Yet, all of these points are linked to you and thus are available for you to change. What would be considered a change on that information? That would be you going back to an event and changing the angle of observation of that event. Changing the geometry. Because how are you mapping? So, proof, first of all, that your genes are being mapped this way. They discovered recently, it's called epigenetics. They realized that not only aren't your genes stable, that is, they map a certain set of information, that's it, you're born with that set and it doesn't change. They realized that it's not only changing, but it's changing almost every second, depending on your state of emotion. So, your genealogy, right, is being modified by your set of emotions. Now, why is that? When you change a vector in space, you're changing your imprint. You are imprinting on the structure of space. You are informing the universe on your experience through your emotions. So when you go back and you find a place where you had a strong emotion, that's producing a very specific presence. If you go back, and this is actually the base of psychology, they just don't know. You can go back, and a psychologist, for instance, will ask you to think of an event, and they might suggest a new perspective, a new angle on the event. And if you adopt that new angle, you actually change the emotional state of that information set on the structure of space-time, billions of, you know, miles or kilometers away from you. And that has a future impact on your present. Notice the word future. Because for that moment, the present is the future. And it has a backward impact through all of your genealogy. and all your ancestry. You are actually in charge of the evolution of the whole thing, being the only one in the present that can do something about it. So it is literally back into the future. Because in this present, you're mapping emotional information on the structure of space-time, which determines your future. Isn't that correct? So it is a constant feedback between the past and the future, and the past and the future, and the past and the future. And the way it manifests itself in physics, there is only two force left, right? Because I eliminated all the rest. Gravity and electromagnetic field. One is the structure of the vacuum, is the information going in you. And the other one is the information radiating out the electromagnetic field. And that is the feedback of creation. Gravity going in, electromagnetism coming out. And the two feed back and learn about itself and evolve through an infinite amount of time. And these feedback structures are at the base of your impact on the whole universe. They're the source of your power. There are the bases of your consciousness. You are conscious because you are doing the feedback dance with all of the universe. You are the universe learning about yourself at one specific coordinate in space-time. And saying, this is what I look like. And this is what I think everybody else looks like. So, by realizing that, you can make massive amount of changes on all of history. And you start to realize the impact of your existence in the universe. You start to realize your responsibility to all things, but more importantly, you start to realize how much support. I mean, your cheerleaders is the rest of all of the things in the universe. They're all like going, yeah, go! And the thing that we call a small voice is actually shouting. But the veil is so thick, it sounds like, oh, what was that? Oh, no, that's the rest of the universe screaming at you. Dude, turn left! You need to meet so-and-so. I don't know, I heard a little small voice tell me to turn left, so I met you. Isn't that coincidence?
Unified field theory at its highest iteration, because it's not just the forces.
So are you or anybody you know working on the practical application of getting the free energy out of this?
Yes. Good doing any practical application to like produce free energy out of this, or are you all like losing it in theory? And I assure you, I didn't write these physics just because of what I call mental masturbation. This is all about hard work, because you see what happens is that they drop you off on this faraway planet, far in the darkest corner of the galaxy, and they tell you, okay, you gotta make it home with the local available materials. And that is a definite epic. Right. You'd be amazed how difficult it is. Ah, let me rephrase this. You'd be amazed how difficult it has been to finance infinite amount of energy, space drives. Let's become universal beings. Let's not be stuck on the surface of a planet. Yes, the old man. I've been in meetings with very influential people, with lots of funds, and showed them little devices that extract energy directly out of the vacuum. And was asked questions like this: how can you make it so it dies after a little while? Because I want to sell more than one to every person on Earth. And like, well, you know, that's the other direction. We're trying to get rid of that part. I've worked my whole life so you don't have to recharge the thing. So conceptual problems happen. When you try to tell people, like, okay, we're going to make a space drive. We're going to travel through wormholes across the galaxy, across the universe, across multiverse, because that's the region I'm going to. This, you know, can become a problem on planets of this kind. So, let me get past. Yes, the space drive is being worked on. We need support. We need funds. We need resources. They're coming. Yes, this is a little bit past Kickstarter. Yeah. So obviously, if you have, see, now I'm gonna have to do a jump to give you a little bit of background. But when you describe this dance, right, you saw that it makes a double torus type of structure. This double torus is the structure of black holes. The error that was done in the standard model is that they didn't include torque and Coriolis effect to the structure of black holes. That's why they didn't have the double torus structure. When you realize that, then you start building corals that reproduce that structure. And you know that if you want to do the little wormhole thing, you better spin stuff up. Right? And so you build corals in which you can put a crystal structure in the middle with gases in it. So that, because when you do the calculation, how fast you gotta spin stuff up, it's gotta spin really, really fast. old black hole to occur in your little laboratory, and now you've got the door to all the wormhole structure of the universe. So, you can't do it by spinning magnets or anything like that, so you conclude, well, how does the universe does it? It's in plasma, right? Stars, galaxies, you know. So, you make the coils, and then you put, you know, you wrap the coils so that you're going to reproduce what stars do, the plasma dynamics in stars, the double torus thing. You're making a little galaxy in a crystal. And what's in the middle of a galaxy? A black hole. And so, you connect the coils so that you can wet them in sequence so that you can force the little plasma particles, which are charged, to follow the magnetic field. And since you can pulse the coils really fast, you can spin the thing up to serious levels. In order to do that, you gotta need a new, good lab facility and so on, and that has been the issue. However, I did a first iteration on a shoestring budget, which is this. And, when I powered it up, in the first iteration, 1999, my floors of my house started warping. Those are gravitational waves. So it was trying to lift my house off the ground. The thing is that I was just renting. Because I'm on a shoestring budget. And, you know, my first thought was, I don't think I have renter's insurance for this. You know, you call your landlord, you say, well, I've got news and bad news. The good news was my experiments worked. The bad news is the house is on its way to help us in Europe. So, you know, in the second iteration, I, you know, started building very spiffy, hefty, you know, Faraday cage, and, you know, containment chambers and so on. However, I was not able to finish this iteration for many different reasons. Some of these reasons I'm discovering actually just recently. Influences that I was unaware of. And so these field equations have impacts. I did have a little crystal in there, and I'm excited to announce that some of these crystals are coming to you soon. Yes, baby. I'm sorry?
What RPM
does it achieve? So this first iteration was going very slow, 5,000 RPM. The second iteration was due to be fired 6 months at, from when I lost the lab, which stopped me from doing the job. And that one was engineered to go from 0 to 20 million RPM smoothly. So I was on my way to Alpha Centaurus, and I was willing to pick up anybody on the way that needed to ride their plan of their choice. And so that didn't happen. It's on its way. But the little crystal that was in the middle, which is a sphere that has been emptied out, a crystal sphere that has been emptied out, and that has a crystal tetrahedron in there, and I just don't have time to go into all the details of why that is necessary. And this was the first iteration, it has to have more than one. Anyway. This crystal, after 11 years, so it's been some 11 years, is still spinning the field with no input power. Only power was given to the system for 45 minutes 11 years ago. And it has a physical effect. It's not as strong as it used to be because this was never spun to the height or the frequency it needed to go. So the focus of the singularity is very weak. And so, but it has effect. That is, it can modify water, for instance, or crystals that are placed close to it. So I've got these little crystals that will be available soon that are placed in the vicinity of the mother crystal for a few days. And what happens is these little crystals, which are cut very, very in a special way, they're lab-grown crystals that are grown, you know, oriented to, so that all the molecules in the crystals or in the crest, they're all aligned. And then the crystal is cut so that all these molecules are aligned to one point. And then the crystal is placed in the large vortex of the larger device, and that imposes a vortex onto it. It's just like making it, you could think of it as a crystal magnet. And it is very easy to feel the force that is generated. It's literally a little space-time vortex, and you can feel it, right? It opens little energetic vortex doorways on your body and other things. And these things will be mounted in little titanium saddles that allows you to click it into a pendant, into a bracelet, or into a device I'm making that is going to go on your hand that you click in, and then you can heal with it, gravitational acupuncture. Very, very sweet. Basically, you're increasing the information network in that region of space, and it's tangible. It's not, you know, I put it in the hands of, like, burly men, you know. It's like, do you want to fill my crystal up?
I don't fill crystals.
No, check it out.
Whatever.
Okay, I'll try. Ah, I can feel it. What is wrong with this thing? And so, in the next few months, it's been 11 years that I have those. So that produces measurable effect. You can modify water from it. Yeah. This is a 2001 test. This one, you know, water, this is the tap water, this is the charged water. So the difference was that the water was placed beside the large vortex within, for 20 minutes. You can see the pH changed from 7.7 to 8.3. The conductivity changed. Many of the minerals in the water changed significantly enough that the lab asked me to redo it, because they kept on saying the water must be from a different source. And then this is the test that was done, and I wanted, you know, since I lived with the thing, I wanted to make sure it was positive on life, right? So we put an independent lab again, people that was involved with the lab, but this was done away from the lab. I'm sorry? No. This is directly with the water I was charging. So here is the lab, the water from the lab, you know, just a straight control. This is the water put beside the device for 20 minutes. This is the water from their lab, and that's the filtered with reverse osmosis and softened, and then there's the tap water. And so October 27, 2000, they put four flowers in all the waters that came from the same plant and that bloomed the same morning. November 6, 2000, you know everybody's happy. November 16, you can see the reverse osmosis one is losing it, this one is starting to lose it. This is the control, this is the charge. November 19, these guys, this is the control, this is the charge. Almost a month later, okay, this is the, you know, control, this is the charge. So you can tell, you know, it does a pretty good job on life. And that's because, you know, life is information through the structure of the vacuum, so you amplify the amount of information that moves through, boom, you have more life. Right? And water is the main component that you're modifying, because water is the antenna that makes the link. And so this is not directly, you know, power out. Power out is possible. Let's put it in those realms. And but more importantly, as far as I'm concerned, gravitational field control is eminent. And that is the most important thing we need at this point. It is not safe for a civilization to stay stuck to the surface of their planet. That is only good for a little bit of time. It's like the mother, you know, bird and the nest and the baby bird thing. At one point, the baby bird gets kicked off the nest. And if it can't fly, it's shit out of luck. It hits the ground. And we are at that point. We even have been given very precise calendars by very advanced civilizations that, by the way, could cut crystals with no tool marks. And have told us how long we have in the little nest before we must ascend. Now, the tendency has been taught to think that ascension was only like a spiritual concept. Ascension is getting the DX, folks. Because any civilization in the universe that made it past this level of advancement is a civilization that has figured out how the universe works, how to extract infinite amount of energy from it, and how to control gravitational fields. It's a civilization that has grown from being on the surface of a planet to becoming a galactic community, to living in the universe, literally, not being stuck to one surface. And I assure you that any civilization that does not succeed at doing that, this will perish. Because planetary structures don't just hang out forever with nice little atmospheres and nice little water in the right place and, you know. Only a very slight change produces very large havoc for these civilizations. Cosmologically, these changes are irrelevant. They they don't even register. Like, you know, the Earth's atmosphere, for instance, is like if you took a billiard ball and you put one layer of paint on it. That's about the thickness of our atmosphere. One, and it's like a little grain of sand beside the sun. One sun flare, good enough, in the right direction, and the atmosphere would just go, tip. And the rest of the solar system would go, what was that? Jupiter would go, oh, that was Earth's atmosphere. Don't worry about it. I mean, and we'd be done, right? It's remarkable that we're still here to talk about it. We're floating in some insane amount of grace. But I wouldn't push it. And what is the difference between our civilization going galactic? You realizing that you are a galactic being and acting as such. The only difference is our willingness to identify with the whole universe instead of thinking that we're some isolated system separated from all things, abandoned on this faraway planet. And with this realization, applied it to our technology to reach ultimate abundance and thrive as a galactic community, part of many other communities that I have been waiting for us to grow and mature to this level. And I can say that in confidence, you know, since I have my source. So, thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight. Connected to the Residence Project Foundation, become a member of the foundation. We're going to finance this by the people, for the people. So help us. And I'm happy to take questions for a little while. Thank you.
Tell your friends. He's also speaking at Sebastopol on Tuesday night and the 19th. You can find information out on the Harmony Festival website or through just email us. Have a Tuesday night out there at the hall, tell your friends. And they've got a lot more room than we do. Thank you all for being here. And the team is going to take some questions, but we are giving you a chance to leave if you're ready to leave.